Well, my name is James Rochford. I'm going to be your instructor for the next 10 weeks on the subject of Christian apologetics. I have taught this course before for the college and adult ministry. Last time I taught this class, there were 7 people signed up. So I'm not kidding. Sometimes I would start and there'd only be 2 people there in the room. It was me and 2 other guys looking at each other. So nice to see a big turnout here. And I'm just glad to see that our fellowship is placing such a high priority on the subject of Christian apologetics. Well, as we get started here tonight, let's begin with a word that is so confusing that it makes both advanced calculus and the opposite sex seem simple. I'm speaking, of course, of the word faith. Perhaps no other word in our culture is met with such derision, confusion, suspicion, hatred, or just downright perplexity. Maybe you're here with us tonight and you are thinking about the word faith, but you find that you yourself are confused regarding this subject. Well, if you are in that position here tonight, join the club, because many people in our culture are in exactly the same position that you are in. In fact, many people, when they hear the term faith, long to believe in something beyond our natural world. However, they're deeply confused and perplexed by the subjects. For instance, a man you might know, Tom Brady, has been in the NFL for 10 years now. He has taken his team, the New England Patriots, to the Super Bowl 5 out of those 10 years. 3 out of the 5 years, Brady has won a Super Bowl. And then 2 out of the 3, he was MVP. He has the NFL record for most touchdowns in a single season. As you can tell, good-looking guy, famous, rich, successful, talented. However, back in 2005, in a 60 Minutes interview with Steve Croft, Tom Brady surprisingly said this, quote, "Why do I have 3 Super Bowl rings and still think there is something greater out there for me?" I mean, maybe a lot of people would say, hey man, this is what it is. I reached my goal, my dream, my life. Me, I think, God, there's got to be more than this. I mean, this can't be what it's all cracked up to be. I mean, I've done it. I'm 27. And what else is there for me? Well, at this point in the interview, Steve Croft leaned forward and nudged. So what's the answer? I wish I knew, he said. I wish I knew. Isn't that interesting? You've got a guy here, famous, respected. He's got women hanging all over him. He's dated 2 supermodels. I mean, he looks like a male model. Look at that picture there, okay? He's tons of money, tons of talent, everything under the sun. And yet this guy feels like there's something missing. He has everything our culture says is valuable, and yet he still feels like there's something missing. Brad Delp, lead singer of the classic rock band Boston, one of my favorite bands, actually. I'm sure you've heard of the song, More Than a Feeling. I promised my wife I wouldn't sing it. So I'm going to break my promise. More than a feeling. More than a feeling. Anyways, I'm sure you know the song. Brad Delp, lead singer of Boston, classic rock band. Very successful, very talented, vocally very talented. And yet at the age of 55 in 2007, Brad Delp committed suicide. Think of that. He's talented, he's got money, he's got success, he's got fame, he's got everything under the sun, and yet he committed suicide. As investigators and family members came into his house, which had been filled with carbon monoxide, is the way that he decided to end his own life, they cleared out the house and pinned to Delp's shirt, read the suicide note, which said simply, "I am a lonely soul." Isn't that interesting? We've got 2 examples here. And, you know, I don't really think I need to even convince you of this fact, that many people in our society are going for money, power, prestige, beauty, and yet they're coming up empty. There's a sense of vacancy, a sense of emptiness in their lives, of which they're incredibly aware. For some people, it's led them just to feel kind of an existential crisis, like Tom Brady. Others, like Delp, it's ended in complete tragedy and despair. Well, some people are deeply confused about the subject of faith. Other people are suspicious. In fact, when we use the term faith, I'm sure many of you were thinking to yourself a lot of the evil things that go on in our world in the name of faith. For example, when we use the term faith, For some people, the first thing that pops into their mind is church abuse. You know, if I said that I was talking with a real holy man recently, many people think that that's a good thing. Others take it as a real pejorative term. You know, they think of holy men as the one who get into sex scandals. Others, when they think of the term faith, think of the rubble of the Twin Towers. Those were real men of faith who performed that act, that terrible and tragic act in the World Trade Center. So for some people, they're downright suspicious. Some people think of the televangelists, apparently married to the Bride of Frankenstein. Last known photo. You know, we've all turned on the cable television late night. We've seen just tons of televangelists. They're sweating like a 10th round boxer, screaming the name of Jesus, pickpocketing people's money. A lot of people, when they think of faith, this is the first thing they think of. Others think of the horrific cult groups. For example, Heaven's Gate cult led by Marshall Applewhite. Applewhite convinced 30-some other people to drink the poisoned Kool-Aid in hopes that when they killed themselves, that they would somehow be teleported to the alien spacecraft behind Hale-Bopp Comet, and then they would be transported to Valhalla on the other side of the universe. Other people like Jim Jones led a massacre of 918 people being killed. Here's photos from Heaven's Gate in 1997 and Jonestown in 1978. So here's the point. Let's wrap this all together here. Some people are confused. Other people are suspicious. Some of the most horrific acts that have ever been done have been done in the name of God or in the name of faith. Here's the question. How could people go so far astray? How can some people's faith lead to moral fruit in their lives? It can lead to caring for the poor, taking care of other people. And yet other people, their faith can lead to things like this, just horrific atrocities in immoral acts. Well, before we look at the evidence for the Christian God, what we're going to do is look at three separate guidelines. We're going to talk methodology. As we search for God, what are some guidelines that we should hold to as we perform our study here? Well, I'm going to give you three separate guidelines. Number one is reason. Number two is faith. And number three is urgency. I think this is the trifecta. You need all three. Two out of the three doesn't work. With only two out of the three, you run into some of the problems that we saw earlier. Well, let's get started with that first guideline, reason. Not checking our mind at the door. Now, you'd think this would just be patently obvious that as we study the subject of God, that we shouldn't check our mind at the door. And yet, embarrassingly, there is an entire subset of Christianity called fideism. Fideism. It comes from the Latin root fide, meaning faith. And an ism is just a worldview. So, for example, we could break down other worldviews in the same way. Theism is just theos, meaning God, and ism, meaning worldview. A worldview based on one infinite personal God. If you're a Christian theist, you believe in the Christian God. Atheism would be a theos ism. The alpha being the negation, the prefix in the Greek. Theos meaning God. Ism meaning a system of belief. So atheism is literally the negation of a belief in one infinite personal God. Polytheism, many gods-ism. Pantheism, everything God-ism. Here is fideism. So I'm sure you can already tell what the definition of fideism is. It's the belief in faith. To give a proper definition, the belief that spiritual knowledge depends on faith or reason alone. So let me try to advocate for this view for just a second. Let me try and represent it in a proper way. If you talk to a fideist, which would just be a Christian who believes that we shouldn't use evidence, they would probably say something like this. If we offered evidence for God's existence, then this would leave no room for faith. I'm sure you've heard some people say, if we prove that there is a God, then there'd be no reason to believe in him. And yet, doesn't the Bible teach, 2 Corinthians 5:7, that we walk by faith, not by sight? God values faith. It's brought up countless times in the Bible. So a fideist will usually ask themselves, you know, why would we want evidence or reason if it's supposed to be by faith alone? Well, under this definition, a Christian thinker would either just be a moron or an oxymoron. I'm not sure. I'll leave that up to you to decide. But skeptics look at this perspective and just think, why would I ever want to get into faith if these two things are contradictory, faith and reason? When I'm talking to someone with a fideistic background, I usually ask them a question like this. Does this mean that we should pray for less evidence so that we can believe more? Think about that for a second. Okay. God, I just really pray that somewhere in Palestine they find the body of Jesus so that I can believe in the resurrection even more. God, I pray that they would, you know, find new artifacts and archaeological discoveries that would contradict what the Bible teaches so that I can believe in your word just even more. I can be even more faithful. That's nonsense. And of course, nobody ever prays prayers like that, do they? To put it simply, we cannot avoid using reason in regards to faith. We can only avoid bad reasoning. It's an entirely drastic misstep to cut reason out of the picture. Everything you do is through reason. Even making assertions like we don't need reason is a reasonable assertion. We can't avoid reason. It's necessarily involved with our search for God. But even more importantly than this, a more important reason why we should reject a fideistic perspective on faith is that Jesus Christ didn't advocate fideism. Jesus Christ didn't believe in blind faith. Let's take a quick walk through the Gospels. Jesus appealed to miracles, to his resurrection, and to predictive prophecy to validate his message. Later, actually throughout all four Gospels, Jesus appealed to the classic a fortiori argument form. There's too many references to list. It's all throughout the four Gospels. An a fortiori argument is not used as much anymore, though it should be, because they're actually pretty good arguments. A fortiori literally means for a stronger reason. Let me give you an a fortiori argument. If I gave you $100 and you were happy, how much more happy would you be if I gave you $1,000? Well, Jesus uses this kind of argument form throughout the four Gospels regularly. It was very popular in the first century. Jesus Christ would debate publicly. Mark 12:28, Jesus held debates where people could listen in. His opponents would try to trap Jesus. Could you imagine that? Jesus Christ is walking around. People are trying to intellectually trap him. But he argued so persuasively that they were amazed. Matthew 22:22. In one case, Jesus, quote, silenced his opponents in debate. If you just go through Matthew 22, it's at the very end of Jesus' ministry, right before he takes up the cross. Up until this point, Jesus had asked close to 200 questions of his opponents. He would engage, he would ask, he would talk with them. But finally, towards the end of his life, Jesus Christ slammed these people with intellectual argument. They're trying to trap him, and he would circumvent their argumentation. Finally, at the end of this chapter, in verse 46, Matthew records, quote, "No one was able to answer him a word, nor did anyone dare from that day on to ask him another question." So apparently, when it came time to debate, Jesus could silence the opposition. Now, of course, he didn't do this earlier in his ministry because he didn't want to scare people off. Christ wanted to be very approachable, allow people to come to him. However, before he took up the cross, I think, my opinion is, Jesus probably wanted to show them that their problems with him were not intellectual. They were moral and spiritual. So at the very end of his ministry, he held out a huge public debate and schooled the opposition. Phidias will usually come back and say, well, okay, it seems like Jesus used evidence, but wait a minute. We have Mark 10:14. Mark 10:14 says that Jesus wanted the faith of a child. He said you have to become like one of these children to enter into the kingdom of heaven. Didn't Jesus teach that he wanted the faith of a child? He doesn't want somebody arguing and using their mind. Children are ignorant. They're gullible. And, you know, God doesn't want someone getting their mind in the way of following him. But he wants somebody who's like a kid, who's just, you know, willing to listen and not having to argue and that sort of thing. Well, I don't know about you, but I think that is a terrible interpretation of Mark 10:14. First off, Ephesians 4:14 teaches that we should no longer go on as children. Now, a skeptic will say, see, the Bible's contradictory. Jesus said he wanted the faith of a child. Paul said, don't have the faith of a child. No. Jesus was saying that he wants the faith of a child in regards to dependence and trust. Paul was saying he does not want the faith of a child in regards to rationality, logic, and evidence. In the context of Ephesians 4 is the subject of false teaching. Paul says you should not be tossed to and fro by every wind of doctrine and false teaching, but you should be able to discern what's actually true from false. That's the context of Ephesians 4. Mark 10, however, the context, verses 1 through 13, is the self-righteousness of the Pharisees. The end of Mark 10 is the pride of wealth. So the context, you see, you've got Jesus's command to have the faith of a child in between, sandwiched in between self-righteousness and pride. In other words, Christ was teaching that not emphasizing the virtue of stupidity or ignorance, but instead he was extolling the virtue of dependence. Little children are dependent on their parents. That's what he wanted, not somebody who's going to be autonomous and self-righteous. This is the way that Dr. Francis Schaeffer describes it. This is in his book, Two Contents, Two Realities. Regarding Mark 10, he writes, did you ever see a little child who didn't ask questions? People who use this argument must have never listened to a little child or been one. My four children gave me a harder time with their endless flow of questions than university people ever have. Good point. I mean, have you ever been around kids? What's the number one question that little kids ask? Why? We need to go to the store. Why? Because our family is going to starve to death if we don't. Why? Because our bodies weren't made to live without getting bread. Well, why do we have to go to the store? Because that's where the farmers bring the food. Well, why? Well, because we can't just all farm, because we need to go to the store. It's a central location where we can get food. Well, why do we have to do that? Because we have to get in the car. If you finally listen to kids over and over, they're so curious, investigating, trying to figure things out. It's really a good point from Schaeffer. Well, we can also point out that Jesus' followers didn't advocate blind faith either. Ancient attorneys had a word for their legal defense in a court of law. In the Greek language, this word was apologia. Apologia. It's used in this sense in Acts chapter 22, verse 1. Paul is on trial in court. He gets up in front of the people in this trial and he says, brothers and fathers, listen now to my apologia, to my defense, a legal defense. When it came time for the New Testament authors to pick a word, to describe the way in which Christians should defend their faith, they latched on to this word, apologia. For example, in 1 Peter 3:15, Peter writes, always be ready to make a defense. The term here is apologia. Always be ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence. So let's, don't miss what he's saying here. Always be ready. So this implies not that you can do this verse when you're talking to someone. If you're always ready, as the Boy Scouts say, be prepared, right? You can't be ready in the moment. You need to be ready in advance. This implies that study is involved, that we should be knowing how to defend our faith. Okay, make a defense. Think of all of the connotations that this word would conjure up in a first century audience. Think about it like this, okay? You're in court, in a court of law. What kind of qualities would you want your lawyer to have? I'd want him to be smart. I'd want him to be well-spoken. I'd want him to be prepared. I'd want him to know what the counterarguments are. I'd want him to show up. I'd want him to defend my case. Absolutely. You know, wouldn't it be terrible if you had a lawyer show up for your defense and he said, you know, why do we really even need this evidence stuff anyways? Can't we just strap this guy into the electric chair? Who really cares in the end? Of course, that would be awful. So by using this term apologia, they were conjuring up kind of a legal defense. Okay, so always be ready to make a defense to some people. Wait, to everyone who asks you to give an account. In many ways, this verse is completely unfair. The Bible teaches that we should defend our worldview, rationally defend it, to every other person on earth. Okay, every worldview, every bit of evidence. It's not that we can just defend it to certain groups of people, but everyone. Very difficult task. For the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence. So we don't want to forget that final clause either. Oftentimes, apologetics draws these type of people that are kind of pugnacious, argumentative. The Bible is against that. The Bible says we should argue. The Bible says we should not be argumentative. Some people call this winning the argument but losing the person. The Bible doesn't teach that we should lose the argument and win the person. The Bible teaches we should win the argument and win the person. We should be gentle and reverent, be respectful, and hold back if we feel like we're steamrolling or being patient with people. One final thing to point out with 1 Peter 3:15, who's it addressed to? Leaders? No. It's addressed to every Christian believer. This is not the responsibility of the leaders in a church. It's the responsibility of every single Christian who claims to follow Christ. Well, the converse of this can be found in Romans 1:20, where Paul writes this: "For since the creation of the world, God's invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made." So what's he saying? Since God created the world, you could look out at the cosmos and discern something about God's attributes, power, and nature. We call this natural theology, being able to see God through nature, certain attributes that he has. He says that these arguments are so strong that people are without excuse. Well, the Greek term here is anapologetos, without excuse. And even without being educated in the Greek language, Koine Greek, I bet you could figure out what that word means. It begins with the alpha, which is the Greek prefix, just meaning the negation, ana, and apologetos, apologia, no apologia. They have no defense, is how strong the evidence is, according to Paul. Moreover, we can point out that Paul himself, quote, reasoned and persuaded throughout his missionary journeys. When Paul was traveling across Asia Minor, Luke records that Paul was reasoning with people. 2 Corinthians 10:5, of course, says that we tear down strongholds and everything raised up against the knowledge of God. The rest of those passages, Acts 9:22, Acts 17:2, Acts 17:4, Acts 17:17, Acts 18:4, Acts 18:19, Acts 18:28, Acts 26:25, Acts 26:28. Were you sick of hearing all those numbers? What does that mean when God repeats something over and over in the Bible? It means it's being emphasized. Why is it being emphasized? For a purpose. In this case, when Paul goes out into territory where people don't know God, what you notice is that the apologetics get cranked up through the roof. He leans on them quite a bit. Not only is this prescribed, but we see countless examples of it in the book of Acts. Here's the point. If you find blind faith appealing, then Christianity is not the faith for you. Okay? I don't know if I could be any more blunt than that. You wouldn't like the founder of Christianity, and you wouldn't like his closest followers. You would not get along. Clearly, the Bible proposes that we ought to defend our faith with reason and evidence. So the first guideline is reason. The second guideline is faith. Well, religious believers are often scared of reason. Skeptics are often scared of faith, this entire notion. What I'd like to argue here tonight is that everyone has faith. This is not that bizarre of a concept. People here, people in life, demonstrate acts of faith all the time. We all exercise faith on some level. Let's think of a few examples. I remember going out to eat with a buddy of mine. He was kind of a skeptic. Sat down, we got a burger, we were talking about faith, and why I believed, why he didn't believe. It was a really good conversation. And at a certain point, he said, you know, I just can't believe. I can't have faith. I said, dude, you're actually having faith right now. He said, no, I'm not. I said, yes, you are right now. And he was just about to bite into this really big, juicy cheeseburger. I said, did you watch that line cook that meal? Did you watch him sit on the toilet for 10 minutes before he went behind the line? Did you watch him wash his hands? How do you know that there's not some disgusting disease in that cheeseburger right now that you're about to eat? Well, I didn't see that. I mean, I didn't watch the guy, but I'm, you know, obviously there wouldn't be a restaurant here unless, you know, they prepared food in a clean and a normal way that passed standards. I said, yeah. So you're trusting, you're exercising faith in the reliability of the owner. For all you know, that the cook could have sprinkled poison on that cheeseburger. Of course, that's absurd, but it is an act of faith. You didn't prepare the meat yourself. Or think of it like this. Imagine you're riding on an airplane. Have you ever thought about what it means to ride on an airplane? You're hopping into a big metal casket. You're flying through the air at 500 miles an hour, 30,000 feet in the air. I remember when I went overseas, we were halfway through the Pacific, and I was thinking to myself, you know, if this thing goes down, they will never get to us in time. I mean, we are like way out there. Well, why did people ride on airplanes? Did you watch the pilot before he got into the cockpit? Did you see him visit the bar? How do you know he's not drunk? Do you know that they actually filled up the gas tanks before you guys actually got into the air? Well, of course, that would be absurd. That would be obviously wrong. It'd be like Jack Nicholson in the movie As Good As It Gets. He won't even leave his apartment. He's too afraid of everything, of disease and germs and death. Well, if we're not willing to exercise faith in anything, then we would lead actually an incredibly miserable life. If you're not willing to step out and believe in things, then you would actually just be insulating yourself from a lot of the good things in the world. I would argue you're insulating yourself from God himself. Atheist Richard Dawkins writes in his book, The God Delusion, that he's not 100% certain that atheism is true. Dawkins has a criteria from 1 to 7, 1 being 100% absolutely sure God exists, 7 being 100% absolutely sure God does not exist. Dawkins says, I'm kind of like a 6, okay? Not really a 7, more like a 6. He says on page 73 and 74 that God's existence is of a, quote, very low probability, but short of zero. He's not 100% sure. In fact, there's very few things that you can be 100% sure of. 2 + 2 = 4. Okay, that's mathematically certain. All bachelors are unmarried. Okay, I'm 100% sure of that, by definition. Beyond that, there's not too many more things. And even one of probably the most notorious atheist of the 21st century claims that he's not 100% sure God does not exist. Of course, I don't want to take him out of context. I want to be faithful with this quotation. He argues that, quote, atheists do not have faith. He rejects this idea. And yet, quote, reason alone could not propel one to total conviction that anything definitely does not exist. So I think he's kind of speaking out of both sides of his mouth here. You don't have faith, and yet reason can't actually bring you to that level. He's kind of somewhere in between. Well, here's the point. All of us have a worldview. A worldview is just a way of looking at the world. I talked to one guy who said, well, I don't have a worldview. So what do you mean? I don't have a worldview. Well, what do you believe? I don't believe in anything. That is a worldview. That's called nihilism. Nihil meaning nothing, ism meaning a worldview. You believe in nothing. Well, if you've ever seen The Big Lebowski, We Believe in Nothing, they were nihilists. We all have a worldview. Either you believe in God, you don't believe in God, many gods, gods and everything, or you believe in nothing. That's a worldview. But here's the point. No worldview can be proven. Atheism cannot be proven. It's not 100% certain. Christianity cannot be proven with 100% certainty. Absolutely not. Neither can any worldview. We all have a worldview. No worldview can be proven. Since we're unable to prove any worldview with complete certainty, we need to exercise a certain amount of faith in the worldview which we adopt. Let me repeat that. Since we're unable to prove any worldview with complete certainty, we all need to exercise a certain amount of faith in the worldview we choose to adopt. Faith is necessary. Not only do we exercise it all the time, but we exercise it in adopting a worldview. That brings us to guideline number three, urgency. Urgency. We're here tonight and over the next 10 weeks to discover the evidence for and against the existence of the Christian God. Before we do that, let's ask ourselves a very, very important question. How important is this, the subject that we're discussing here? You know, I don't know about you, but I really hate apathetic people. Sorry if that offends you, but if you're truly apathetic, you probably don't care. Hey, that's talking about me. Screw it. Whatever. Apathetic people drive me crazy. They don't seem interested in life. They don't seem interested in people. They just kind of seem reserved. They don't really care. When it comes to your worldview, when it comes to the existence of God, how can you be apathetic? Think about the questions we're discussing here. Does God exist? Does God want to know me? Or does he want to be hidden from me? Is there a purpose to my life? Will I continue to live after death, or will I become extinct? Are there answers to these questions, or is it all just conjecture and speculation and opinion? And, you know, this person has this opinion and that person has that opinion and I've got my opinion. Are we all just speculating blindly in the dark? Nobody really knows, but we're just going to pretend that we do. Here's the question. How can you be apathetic about these topics? If this is true, if any of these are true, nothing could be more important than this. Okay, let's just focus in on one question here. Eternal life. Is there life after death? Is it that when we die, the lights go out, we become worm food, we get recycled back into the, how did Elton John put it, circle of life, you know, just right back into the natural process, that's all it is? Or is it that when we die, that is beginning a new eternity for us, where we continue to exist? As one friend of mine put it, we were sitting around the fire years ago, talking really late into the night, and he asked me what I believed, and I was asking him what he believed, and I said, you know, I just can't really grasp what you're saying. What do you mean when you say that nothing happens when you die? Can you explain that to me? He said, well, James, you know when you're driving down the highway and you're going about 70 miles an hour and all of a sudden a bug hits your windshield? I said, yeah. It just explodes. That's it. Yeah. He said, yeah, I think it's kind of like that. That's what happens when you die. The lights go out, dead. That's it. Over with. Well, let's consider this question. Is there life after death? Let's put it in these terms. Imagine you're going into a hospital room and you walk into the room and you see a 7-year-old girl. She's about to die. She has some terrible disease. And the family's crowded around her and they're grieving and coming into the stage of acceptance where they see that their little girl's going to die. And just then, blowing through the door, comes this young doctor, and he has a handful of pills. And he says, listen, I know that she's only got weeks to live, but look, this is an experimental medicine. Okay, it's worked on 20 out of 20 test cases. We think it works for this disease. We want to try it. We think this could cure her. It could add 80 years onto this girl's life. Now, if you're anything like me, if I was in that room and that was my daughter, okay, dying, I'd probably be thinking to myself, you know, this probably isn't true. All the other doctors I've talked to said that she's going to die. Okay, this other doctor comes in. He's probably a quack. He has no idea what he's talking about. It could even be that he's just trying to sell us these sugar pills. And we're grieving, we're weak, and so he's trying to move in and take advantage of us. It could just be that this guy's a complete lunatic. Maybe he grabbed a lab coat and somehow snuck into the room. But, you know, this guy's probably not making a true claim. It's not true that this guy actually has a cure to this disease that we've been fighting for the last 2 years. Well, that's a good point. Maybe the guy is not giving a true claim. Maybe what he's saying is false. Maybe it's not real. But let's not pretend that his claim is therefore meaningless. It might not be true. It might be false. He could be lying through his teeth. He could be a complete lunatic. He could be trying to use you. But that doesn't mean that his claim is therefore meaningless. Oh, no, 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 no. It has incredible, incommensurable meaning. Okay, it could extend that girl's life for 80 years. Think about it like this. What if I had a pill that could extend your life until you were 200 years old? How much would that change your perspective? How much would that change your retirement plan? How much would that change your values? Okay, what if I had a pill that could make you live to 1,000 years old? That would definitely change your retirement plan, definitely change your values, definitely change your relationships. Well, what if we had something that could actually bring you not, 200 years or 1,000 years, but an eternity of living after death? Well, you might be completely insane. You might be making that up. Possible? Well, that could be completely false. You could be lying about that. Possible? Does that mean that the claim is therefore meaningless? Absolutely not. The claim has incredible meaning. Well, let's see if we can bring this all to a head here. When it comes to the claim of the Bible, Jesus Christ brought a message of love and forgiveness that is either the most incredible news ever conceived of by mankind, or it's the most egotistical fiction ever conceived of. It's one or the other. Can't be both. Think about what the Bible teaches. The Bible teaches that Jesus Christ was fully God, the creator and sustainer of the universe, incarnated into a human being. He came, lived, had a ministry of miracles, taught, and eventually was crucified and killed. And the Bible teaches that the reason why he did that is to take the penalty for human sin that all of us deserve. Okay? We can't just waltz into the presence of God. We can't do that. God is different from us. He's morally perfect, and we can't just waltz into his presence. But because God died for us, the penalty for human sin was placed onto him, and so we don't have to pay that. And the Bible teaches the only thing we have to do in order to get that gift of forgiveness is just to ask, not earn it, not work hard for it, not plead with God for it, just to simply turn to him and having an opening of the heart and just asking, God, if you're there and this stuff is true, I want Christ's forgiveness to apply to me. I want that. Jesus said, if you ask, it shall be given to you. Christ himself taught that. Now think about that for a second. Either that's the greatest conceivable message we could ever come up with, that we could live in perfect joy with God for eternity, never exhausting how awesome his love and acceptance is. That's the greatest conceivable message you could ever come up with. Or that's the most egotistical thought that has ever entered the imagination of a human being. Okay, years ago, they used to think that the universe circled around the planet Earth. It was geocentric. Think about how arrogant that is, that the whole universe is revolving around us. The message of Christ is far more egotistical than that. That because I'm here and God had to die for me, God, the creator of the universe, died for me in my place. If it's not true, that's the most self-centered, arrogant thought we've ever come up with. However, if it is true, it's what the New Testament calls the euangelion, the good news. Quite an understatement, actually. They just thought of what's the best term we can give for this thing, the gospel, the good news. Now, here's the question. What if there was even a 1% chance that that was true, what I just said? That God loved you so much that he actually came and died for you. What if there was even a 1% chance that that was true? Wouldn't that be worth investigating? Well, I guess it would depend. It would depend how much you valued the meaning of that message. For example, imagine if your son was captured by some kind of a maniac, a pedophile or something like that. And he was put in a van and taken away into the forests of Michigan, which is where all pedophiles dwell. Go Bucks. So he's out in Michigan and the police come and talk to you and they say, your son's been captured. by a crazy maniac. He's going to hurt your son. You say, all right, what are we going to do? Cop says, well, sorry to tell you this, but there's only a 1% chance we're ever going to find your son out there. I mean, there's tons of forest. He could be underground. We have no idea where he is. It could be 1% chance at most. What would you tell the cop? 1%? Oh, wow, that's just totally unlikely. Just tell the boys down at the office to call off the search. Not that big of a deal. I'm sure they have better things to do with their time. 1%, not very good odds. Well, of course, we could put it like this. The intensity of your search for your son would depend on the object of your search. If you didn't really value your son, then those odds, I guess, would really persuade you from ever searching after him. However, if you did value your son, you'd probably search for him until the day you died. In the same way, if this is really true, if what the Bible claims is true, this would be an infinitely important message, something worth searching after. Imagine being lost on a desert island. You know, you and a buddy, Gilligan's Island. It's just you two out there, and your friend turns to you. You're in the shade, and you're going to die out here. There's no more water, food, berries. You've eaten it all up, and you're just kind of laying there in the shade, ready to die. And one of the guys goes out into the bush, and he comes back, and he's stomping his feet, and he's completely ecstatic. He can't control himself. Looks like he's going to wet his pants, you know, and you're like, what? What are you doing? He says, a boat, there's a boat. It's on the other side of the island. I saw it. I think they're just docking for a little bit, and they're going to be here only for a little bit. But I just came back here to rescue you and get you to go with me to go see the boat. And so you, being the skeptic that you are, you turn back to him and you say, a boat out here? And that's really unlikely. And, you know, we barely got on this island ourselves. And, you know, how do you know you even saw a boat? Maybe your sunstroke. I mean, it's really hot out here. And, you know, how do you even know that you're being coherent right now? Your friend turns back to you. Dude, I saw a boat. I'm not lying about that. How do I know that? How do I know you're not just trying to get me out of the shade and take my spot? Okay. So the believer in the boat turns back to you and says, well, why don't you just walk with me to the other side of the island? I mean, it's going to take 20 minutes. If he's there, we'll see him and we'll be rescued. I mean, the reward couldn't be any better. We'll get off this godforsaken island. If you're right, what do we win? We sit here in the shade and we die in a couple days. If I'm right, we're saved. If you're right, we're screwed. Wouldn't it be worth investigating to see if we're going to go over there and find it? Well, the same thing is true with belief in God. Wouldn't it be worth investigating? Wouldn't it be worth looking into? How could you be apathetic about it? Well, let's wrap this up with some conclusions. For the next 10 weeks, we're going to be looking at evidence for the Christian God, whether this claim is actually true or if it's false. Here's a few things that you should consider as you look at the evidence. First, you need to keep an open mind. Okay? If you're somebody with us here tonight who is closed-minded, you've already made up your mind and you've already decided what you believe, and there's no evidence that could counteract that claim, that thought, well, then nothing we study here tonight or over the next 10 weeks is going to make a lick of difference. I just ask that you would keep an open mind and consider whether this could really be true. Secondly, decide if you find the evidence for the Christian worldview better than the alternatives. What we're not claiming is that the Christian worldview has no problems. It has many difficulties, things that are hard to resolve, things that are difficult to deal with. Absolutely. That's part of having a worldview. But what I would ask is that you would compare the difficulties with the Christian worldview with every other worldview that's out there, every other option, and decide which one you find to be the most cogent or persuasive. Finally, number three, be prepared to receive Christ if you find persuasive evidence. You can think about it as buying a car. You know, when you go to buy a car, you hop on Kelley Blue Book, you get on Craigslist, you look at the price of the car, you compare cars, you might even go out and test drive a few cars, you might ask people, a mechanical friend who knows that model, that make, that year. But eventually, you know what you have to do? You have to buy a car unless you want to walk everywhere for the rest of your life. Okay? You have to make a decision. Eventually, you can't just be in limbo forever. The same is true with belief in God. Jesus said in Matthew 12, whoever is not with me is against me. By not making a decision for Christ, that's the same as saying, Christ, I don't want you in my life. It'd be like if you got a gift for your wife, you handed her a nice bracelet, you know, spent a lot of money on it, and you go out to dinner, your anniversary, hey, here's the gift, honey, I can't wait for you to see it, and she sees the gift, and she's like, yeah, it's really, really nice, so what do you want to order? And you're like, are you going to open the gift? I'll open that later, you know. So you're like, okay, so you eat dinner, and then at the end of the dinner, you're like, are you going to open the gift I got for you? We'll open that when we get home. Okay, so you get home, and your wife doesn't open the gift that night either. And then a week passes, she still doesn't open the gift. And then a year passes, and I'm going to get around to opening that gift. I'll get to it at some point. You know, at some point, you'd probably go to marriage counseling. You know, what's going on here? Why don't you want to open my gift? Same is true with God. You know, God has bought, sold, and paid for your forgiveness on the cross. He's taken care of that. And by saying, I don't want to open that, I don't want to receive that, that's offensive to God. God said, I bought this incomparable gift for you. You're not going to open it. At some point, if you find this persuasive, you need to turn to God and receive his gift of forgiveness.